Welcome back, everyone, to the XCast. The truth is in here. I'm your host today, Kyle Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for this, which is an episode all about the brilliant installment of the X-Files, Oubliette, which I know you'll have recently heard me talking about with Brandon Shea Mutala, but there's more to be said about Oubliette, I think, so we wanted to delve even deeper into the episode. And what I thought was, I'd spoken to Chris Knowles a while ago, I think it was during our Podwatch series when we talked about Conduit, and he started to talk a bit about the symbology at play in Oubliette, and I had to sort of bring the conversation back round to Conduit at the time, but I sort of made a mental note to try and return to it if at all possible. So what I did was I invited Chris on, and I just really gave him the chance to outline what his thoughts were, really. So he goes into a bit of detail here, and it's really fascinating stuff. And we sort of get onto a few other X-Files-related topics as we go along, but we always kind of circle back to Oubliette as we do so. So that's what we're here for today. I think the best thing is, after this next jingle, and without any further ado, we get on with the show. Yeah, so we're going to discuss, I'm going to let you talk about like the symbolism in this episode. But I mean, before we come on to it, I mean, this is one of my favorite episodes, really, Oubliette. I mean, do you feel the same way?
Oh, absolutely. For a long time, it actually was my favorite episode. For a long time, it was. I really focused on this episode. I really thought it was like just so central to the X-Files and to the overall, you know, thrust of the series and the overall, you know, the theme of the series that I think is baked right into the mix from the pilot on. You know, the situation with Mulder and his sister and how that drove his obsession, and you know, later on how they developed that storyline and how it plays into the mythology. I just thought that it was incredibly powerful episode, and incredible performance by David Duchovny, you know, and Gillian Anderson as well. But I think that it's undervalued in a lot of ways. And I also think it sort of set the stage for a lot of episodes to follow, particularly Paper Hearts. I think that Vince Gilligan was very affected by this episode and wanted to follow on. I think you can really trace sort of a through line from this to Paper Hearts and up to Sign and Zeit and Closure. Yeah. And, you know, there are probably a lot of stops in between, but I think that those three sort of form their own trilogy within the arc of the series, and in that regard, I mean, I really see this episode as a mythology episode, and not only because of the subtext of Mulder's sister and the abduction, but also how it ties into the greater mythological narrative, and that is the myth of Demeter and Persephone. Or Demeter. I mean, you can pronounce it either way, but I think that there is a a very strong and I think a very deliberate injection on the part of Chris Carter of this mythology, you know, classical mythology into, you know, the X-Files mythology. I think that this was deliberately engineered from the start. And that I think that there are all sorts of clues throughout the series that are dropped, that, you know, indicating this. But I also think this storyline, this mythological arc, you know, from classical mythology, really follows up straight up into the I Want to Believe film. Mm. And I think there are even arguments that, you know, a variation on it can be seen through the revival with the William arc, and that the William arc is kind of a variation on it, you know, sort of a gender swapped variation with gods such as Attis and Adonis, and that's, you know, it's a very similar storyline where you know, both entail the descent into the underworld, and you know, we see this in the very last scene of My Struggle 4, where, you know, William emerges from the underworld, you know, from beneath the waves. And we see this in I Want to Believe, which I think is some of the most, you know, at the same time, some of the most explicit use of, let's just call it mystery, so we can, you know, because it's from the mystery religions. And mystery religions were a group of sort of a phenomenon of religions in the ancient world in antiquity, where people were rejecting sort of the state cults of Greece and Rome and turning to these very personal savior gods. And this is really the first emergence of that mythos that we see, you know, take full flower in Christianity. So Carter, I think, was very well versed in this mythology, and sort of makes allusions to that in Irresistible, when he has Donnie Faster sort of sitting in a night class for you know, mythological studies, which seems like a very strange thing to do, you know, for anyone. But you know, I think that you know, there's dialogue in that episode that I think Carter really is sort of pointing to what exactly he's trying to accomplish here, and I think it's interesting because we have the this myth of Demeter and Persephone. And let me just sort of, you know, delineate this a bit more for people. Mm-hmm. So basically what it is that there were these cults, these mystery cults in the ancient world, and the most prominent of which was at Eleusis in Greece. And this was sort of a yearly festival. It was sort of like the Lollapalooza or something of the ancient world. Like, seriously, it really was. Yeah. Because, you know, people would come from all around and take drugs and dance and just go crazy and stuff. And it sort of all ended with this performance of the mystery of Demeter and Persephone. And the mystery play here is that Persephone is picking flowers on the slopes of Mount Etna in Sicily. And Hades, the Lord, or Pluto, the Lord of the Underworld, you know, sort of sees her and is entranced by her and kidnaps her and takes her down to hell. And, you know, when Demeter finds out that Persephone has been abducted, she sort of wanders the world looking for her. And as she's doing this, you know, the earth goes barren. And in that very Carter log-ific teaser to Emily, we sort of see the most explicit reference to this, where Scully is literally Demeter. I mean, she's literally walking the earth in search of her daughter, and then, you know, everything turns to dust. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're familiar with the mythology or the mystery arc, it couldn't possibly be more explicit than it is in that teaser. Again, I mean, when we see the in it, I Want to Believe, with the abductions of the FBI agent and the girl at the swimming pool, and you literally see like the Callum Keith Rennie character underwater, you know, so that's indicating that he's in the underworld. And there's all sorts of interesting symbolistic cues in that film that Carter puts in. I mean, quite cannily in that regard. But so really what the X-Files mythology is, and is as established in the very first episode, in that iconic motel room scene, that in any real, you know, if that was in the real world, I mean, that would have ended, you know, in just like really hot, messy sex. I mean, you know, it's just like, but of course it's a science fiction program, so it didn't. So in this mystery cycle, Demeter wanders the earth in search of Persephone, finds out that she has been taken to hell, and with the aid of Hermes, you know, the god of knowledge and writing, who's sort of like, in this storyline, is represented by Skinner, you know, in my estimation, is taken down to the underworld. And, you know, Pluto says to Demeter, well, listen, she's my queen now. She's the queen of hell. I mean, she has to stay here. And they sort of bargain, and Demeter bargains for her to come back to the earth. But Pluto tricks Persephone into eating pomegranate seeds, and so she has to stay for the winter in the underworld. And it's all about, you know, really what it boils down to is that it's a myth about the growing seasons and, you know, how the earth dies in the winter and so on and so forth. I mean, there were only three seasons in ancient Greece. They didn't, it didn't have the same kind of situation we had because of their climate and whatnot. So anyway, so really this mythology, and there are all the variations about it, and Carter was like very clever, and whatever writers were sort of taking part in this were very clever about seeding this throughout the myth arc. So this is why I see Oubliette as a mythology episode, because not only does it have these the parallels with Mulder's sister, even though he, you know, explicitly denies it in the text of this episode, but I mean, where is Amy Jacobs taken? She's taken to the underworld. You know, I mean, that's like the literal reference in the title here. You know, the Oubliette is the basement door. So that theme, you know, the abduction theme that just runs throughout the series. And then there, of course, there are variations on it, you know, where there are male gods like Osiris and Dionysus and so on and so forth, Adonis and Attis. And those are referenced throughout the, and I would argue, you know, quite intentionally and explicitly throughout the series. So it's like, if you really want to understand the mythology and just sort of like this almost like parallel sort of rational, not quite, you know, people sort of see this all as being very haphazard and arbitrary, but in fact, it's more often than not following the arcs of these mystery cycles. And you know, it's not completely esoteric to a lot of people, but I think that if you study the myths, I mean, even like a cursory glance at this mythology, you're going to see it over and over again, you know, and again, all the variations, because, you know, there's the Mulder abduction. And, you know, of course, I mean, Scully herself becomes Persephone in, you know, when she's abducted. So, and there's a lot of gender swapping as far as the, you know, specific roles. But, I mean, here's another example. So, you know, the myth of Persephone is, you know, and I've really detailed this on the blog, is very, maybe not explicitly, but very strongly symbolically referenced in I Want to Believe. But Fight the Future, okay, so Fight the Future, again, it's the journey to the underworld, right? Where does he go? He goes to the bottom of the earth, to Antarctica, and this ship buried deep within the earth. So it's the underworld. I mean, it's literally, I mean, he's literally going to the underworld in more ways than one to rescue Scully, who is, you know, been in prison. And what this myth, particular myth is that it's referencing Orpheus and Eurydice. And of course, there's been a lot of, like, you know, there's a very well-known Brazilian movie called Black Orpheus, and this whole sort of constellation has been referenced in pretty well-known. You know, Jean Cocteau did a film on Orpheus in the late 50s. So there's been, like, this myth has welled up, and I think that Carter, when he was getting his English degree and so on and so forth, was, you know, probably very interested in stuff and studied it in school. And, you know, of course, the great example of this is George Lucas and referencing Joseph Campbell and whatnot. So, I mean, this is, you know, mythological allegory is not only as old as time, but it's as new as, you know, current Hollywood. I mean, it's just like if you want to really tap into those primal storytelling urges, you go for that. So the reason that I think that Oubliette is so powerful is not only just because of the story itself, but, it, you know, it ends up on the River Styx. It's Hades abducting Persephone. I mean, it almost couldn't be more explicit. It's like Amy Jacobs is abducted, and you know, the whole scene plays out, and she drowns in the River Styx, and then she's revived by Mulder. But there's also this sort of transference with Lucy. So this interesting connection between Lucy and Amy, you know, it's like Lucy was once Persephone. She was once the little girl lost, the little girl taken to the underworld. But in her adulthood, she becomes Demeter. She becomes the woman searching, even though she doesn't even realize it, but, you know, through this psychic link, you know, she is now Demeter. It's like this, it's almost like this turnover, this generational turnover where, you know, through her ordeal, she is psychically attuned to the sufferings of this other character. So in that regard, you know, if we wanted to draw the sort of mythological parallels here, we have, mm-hmm. You know, Amy is Persephone, Lucy is Demeter, and Mulder is Hermes. So it's the same core of this mystery told over and over again. And then when you fast forward this to the eighth season, they draw on the male variants of this with Osiris and Dionysus and these figures, yes, particularly Osiris. I you know, one thing that I had done, you know, several years ago is really detailed the parallels between Mulder's abduction and the death of Osiris. And, you know, and again, because, I mean, it couldn't be more explicit because, you know, Scully is Isis, she's the magician, and you know, as well as the consort, and Doggett is Anubis. Anubis is, you know, he's the dog-headed or jackal-headed god, yeah, of the dead. You know, Skinner is the scribe. You know, he's the record keeper. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And, you know, these interesting sort of roles that, you know, these characters come in and out of. You know, for instance, in this instance with Mulder's abduction, when I saw that in that first, you know, appearance of Monica, when she was like sort of staring at the Morley lights, I was like, well, she is Nephthys. And Nephthys is, you know, not only the sister of Isis, but she is the consort of Set, and Set is Satan, Set is the demon. You know, so when Monica ends up with Smoking Man, and everybody's like so outraged about it and so on and so forth, in that instance, it made sense to me because Monica is set up as Nephthys in the allegory that we see throughout the eighth season. So, you know, why wouldn't she end up, you know, with her mythological husband? And again, this might seem a bit arcane and a bit convoluted to some people, but it's actually very simple. I mean, it's like you can just draw out sort of a spreadsheet in Excel and just write down each character in the cast of the X-Files and then just, you know, assign them their mythological, you know, counterparts. And it's actually, you know, very simple. I mean, there are a lot of people who will argue that these myths that repeat with different variations throughout ancient history are really just all based on one myth. There's a core myth, and it just sort of, it's spread to all these different cities and cultures, and they put their own spin on it. But it's really, you know, it's based on a single myth. You know, and some would argue that it's based on the myth of Inanna and Dumuzi, and that goes back to ancient Sumer. So you're talking the first recorded civilization in history, or in our history at least. So again, I mean, this sounds like maybe a little bit, maybe sounds to some people like, you know, reading too much into it, but it's actually like incredibly blatant and obvious if you understand the mythology and you see you know, a lot of the cues, because Carter would put these cues throughout the series. You know, when you have like Zeus Genetics and you have Demeter Road, and you know, he's always sort of dropping in these
Pandora Street was one.
Exactly. So it's all drawing on these you know, these really kind of like foundational myths. You know, we know them from the Greeks, but there is a school of thought, and I think it's a pretty well attested school of thought that these myths all come from, you know, ancient Mesopotamia, from Babylon, and that the Greeks basically absconded a lot of them when they really became very intimately involved with, you know, Babylon in certainly in the late Neo-Assyrian period, but certainly you know, with the rise of you know, Cyrus and Darius and Xerxes and then later on the Seleucid emperors of Babylon, which were just basically Greek generals who had taken Mesopotamia's you know, spoils of war after you know, Alexander's conquest of the known world. Again, it sounds like overly complicated, maybe a little too overly intellectualized to people, but this, to me, it's like art appreciation. You know, it's like if you understand the mythology and you understand how the mythology acts within the X-Files mythology, it really deepens your appreciation, because you really start to see that the, you know, what might seem arbitrary or accidental or just sort of like half-assed and made up as you go along is really sort of following a different cycle. It's following a different narrative, and in that regard, it makes a lot more sense than I think people give it credit for.
No, I think it's fascinating, and it'll be good where we can on the podcast to kind of like call on you from time to time and kind of get you to point us in the right direction, you know. But as you said, you've blogged about it like extensively, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, particularly in regards to I Want to Believe, because when I saw when I first heard about Want to Believe, when I heard what the plot was before I'd even seen it, and it's like, you know, Mulder and Scully are wandering around the wilderness gathering up body parts. I'm like, oh, gee, yeah, that's Osiris. I mean, you know, I mean, that's, to me, it was like a clear signal that we were going to be looking at the mysteries. We were going to look, you know, at this ancient narrative again. And if you just, again, a cursory read of the myths, it's going to just open up like a flower. And the interesting thing in this regard is that it ties into another strand that I've documented throughout the series of the X-Files, and that's this fixation on hallucinogenic drugs, mm-hmm. on what they call an entheogenic theory, and how that ties into, you know, what people call aliens. I mean, it's really fascinating, because all these things, and, you know, and never, you know, because Carter, of course, will never acknowledge anything, you know, ever, you know, the Sphinx. But if you understand, I mean, even just like a Wikipedia reading of the mythology, these ancient mythologies, it's just, you know, a light bulb's going to go off in your head, and it's like, oh my God, this is just everywhere in the X-Files.
Yeah, and in terms of what you were saying about it being like, you know, or being perceived as like too arcane, I mean, in the case of Oubliette, though, like you say, it's quite...
visceral.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got that, like, really, I find it quite chilling visual emblem of like the red light. I mean, do you see that as tying into these things that you're talking about as well?
Yeah, sure, because it symbolizes hell. Yeah. You know, it's like the red fire. You know, like, red has always been associated, at least, you know, in ancient Greece, it would have been gray. But with the rise of Zoroastrianism, again, in Mesopotamia, and how Zoroastrianism influenced the Greeks, and how this combination of Zoroastrianism and Greek thinking really influenced the Jews in Alexandria and Syria, and how this played into the development of Christianity, you know, particularly with things like the angels. The angels are Zoroastrian. The angels are not really known as a separate phenomenon in classical Judaism, you know, pre-Babylon captivity. So that red, it's a very powerful and very simple. I mean, this is the thing that I think is the genius of Oubliette, is that if you really want to look into all the subtext, you can just get lost forever. But they all boil it down to this incredibly brutal and visceral and primal story. I mean, what could be more horrifying? You know, it's like the abduction of a child. It's just sheer terror, you know, particularly if you're a parent. And this is like, you know, why I think the X-Files is sort of underappreciated today, because I think the reasons why it was so zeitgeist and why it was so powerful is that there are all these strands that people are picking up on subconsciously. They're not necessarily intellectualizing, you know, they're not processing on an unconscious level, but it's all there, and it's all just like pressing all those buttons, you know. And again, I mean, I don't think people consciously acknowledged it, but it affected them on a psychological, if not a psychic level. And this is the genius of Chris Carter. I mean, Chris Carter, you know, genius is an interesting phenomenon, because genius, you know, very often goes off the rails. You know, so that's something people tend to acknowledge. I mean, just look at the history of genius. You know, I mean, just look like somebody like a, you know, like a Brian Wilson, just genius itself is messy and dangerous. So, I mean, I think that's just all part of the mix here. But, you know, in this regard, I think what gave X-Files this incredible resonance, and why it just like just just dug its way into people's unconsciousness, is because it's playing on these very old and very powerful and primal, you know, mythologies. And I would argue that Oubliette is one of his best examples of this. And I think, again, I mean, I personally believe, and I didn't ask him or speak to him about this, But I really think that Vince Gilligan was very affected by Oubliette. And I think that Oubliette is really the mother of Paper Hearts. I don't think without Oubliette you would have Paper Hearts. And, you know, without Paper Hearts or Oubliette, you wouldn't have Silence at Enclosure. And, you know, of course, I know some people have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I just remember watching Enclosure, and, you know, when that...
Yeah.
The final credit came up, you know, the produced by Chris Carter. I was like, that was just the most intense, devastating experience that I've ever had watching television. And, you know, and then I went online and everybody's like, oh, that sucks. And it's just like, oh, I just give up on these people forever. I just don't care what they say about anything for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of Oubliette being such like a powerful episode, I think one of the most wrenching like moments is when Mulder comes to Lucy's body at the end. And I know you've got this notion, haven't you, that Samantha was always dead kind of in the minds of Carter and the other writers all along. And,
yeah.
And you sort of see this scene as kind of an analogue for Mulder and his sister's body, do you? Is that right?
Yeah, I do. I think that it's interesting, too, because there is a lot of... There's always been a lot of debate and consternation, because I think everybody just wanted, you know, the skies to open and the flying saucers to descend and you know... Samantha and Mulder to sort of hug and, you know, ride off into the sunset or something. But I think that if you go back and look at it from the very first episode, you know, from the pilot episode, to me, it's, with the eyes that I see now, and I go back and look at it, you know, even on its own, even, you know, independent of the episodes that follow, to me, it's very clear that, you know, because it starts off with a dead girl, right? The very first...
Yep.
Teaser of the series, it's not dealing with a girl who's been abducted and returned. It's a girl who's abducted and is dead, and I think that that's your first clue. And again, you know, Carter's like got this sphinx-like attitude, and he's always being extremely coy and cagey about these things. But it's like that's what it starts off with. It starts off with a dead girl, and then what's the parallel that's drawn? It's Mulder, you know, saying that his sister was abducted by aliens, and to me, it's just like Mulder is unable to deal with the conscious knowledge that his sister is dead, that his sister is lost forever to him. So he has to pursue this, you know, what really starts off as like a ridiculous fantasy, you know, of, you know, she was abducted and, you know, all these different narratives, you know, emerging in the sessions, you know, the hypnosis sessions and stuff. And even like, how like the first episode of the first season and the second the first episode of the second season, you know, tell two completely different stories about how Samantha was taken. You see what I'm saying? So it's like I think that if you draw that back to that first teaser in the series that is about a girl who's abducted from her bedroom and winds up dead, I think that's your first clue, you know. And it's like it could only be like early if it was like, you know, I don't know, somehow like time warped back, you know, before the series even existed. I mean, it's like literally the first thing you see. So to me, that to me is the clue. And again, this is just Carter's thinking, which is very fractal and very sort of fourth dimensional chess. But, you know, he sort of, you know, in all fairness, he does outsmart himself quite a bit throughout the series history. But I think Samantha was always dead. I think that the you know, Mulder's quest was really, you know, he wasn't running towards his sister. He was running away from the reality of his sister's death. And I think that if you approach the series with that understanding, you know, Oubliette just becomes just even more cathartic and gripping and painful and just, you know, and even, you know, in the, with Paper Hearts. Because Paper Hearts, to me, is Mulder, you know, it's like this dawning realization that, you know, so say she was taken and, you know, was returned and so on and so forth, as we see in Sign and Sight and Closure. I mean, it doesn't matter what happened in the interim. What the reality that he's facing now is that his sister is dead and gone and will never return, you know?
Yeah, and in Oubliette, I mean, I do like the fact he rejects the comparison that Scully makes, though. Because I sort of feel it allows Lucy and Amy to kind of flourish as characters in their own right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that was a very canny move. But it also, to me, that is, it speaks to denial as well. I mean, one of the problems that people have with the X-Files, and I find it very frustrating, is that everybody takes what everybody says, you know, at face value, And to me, my basic premise in going into the series is that everybody lies. You know, everybody's constantly lying. And it's like, this is not like me reading something into it. It's like, you know, you can name 100 instances throughout the series where, you know, major characters just flat out lie to one another. So,
Yeah. And like probably 10 instances where the tagline is changed to something about denial or I want to lie or, you know, that kind of deceive, inveigle and obfuscate and all sorts. Just finally then on Oubliette, I mean, I find it kind of baffling why this is kind of, why the fan reaction isn't more kind of positive towards this one.
Is it not positive or is it just sort of neutral and
indifferent, I guess. A lot of fans, I don't know, almost treat it as kind of a middle of the road episode or something. And I mean, what do you put that down to? Because I know you're quite kind of astute on like the fandom and stuff. So, I mean, what do you think it is exactly that people maybe don't key into aside from like the symbolism and stuff? Why don't they enjoy it kind of on a surface level?
I think because it's dark and painful.
Yeah.
And deals with topics that people don't like to think about. You know what I mean? You know, particularly since the fandom is so heavily female, I think that a lot of female fans are uncomfortable, you know, with the story arc because it really plays into their own primal fears, you know, of being the victims of male-directed violence. So, I mean, you know, I can certainly understand that. It's, you know, it's a very difficult and thorny issue to confront, and I don't blame people for that. But you know what I would argue is that a lot of it also has to do with when a lot of fans were watching this, they were basically Amy Jacobs themselves. I mean, they were teenage girls, and it's like it doesn't necessarily hit you on a conscious level, but it hits you on a primal level. And I think that people who were older, and people who had children, I think it probably spoke to them more. You know, again, I mean, one of the things that I really have to impart, and I don't want anybody to be offended by this, but the fandom as we understand it, insofar as online fandom, was just such a small corner of the viewership.
Yeah.
In the series history. I mean, you know, at best, you know, if we looked at online fandom, we could say actively, you know, maybe a few thousand people, right? Mm-hmm. And the few thousand people who are sort of staying with the franchise, you know, 20 years past its peak.
Yeah.
And, you know, fandoms have immense distorting effects. Because I think that the tastes and the opinions of fandom really have no bearing on the tastes and opinions of the 20 million people who are watching The X-Files every week. And I think a lot of those 20 million people were themselves parents, adults, so they responded to these stories differently. And it's always fascinating to me, like, to come from fandom and to be immersed in fandom, and then to step out into the world outside and just see how, like, variously different people who are not fans, who aren't engaged in the culture, aren't engaged in the online fandom, you know, just the way they see the episodes. I mean, you know, one of the examples that I've always given is, like, just how many people just hate the comedy episodes. And I'm always just like, really? You know, it's like, granted, there are a lot of comedy episodes that I don't like, you know, but it's just like, that's sort of like, you know, that's the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. You know, it's like, to me, it's like, that's like such a core of the X-Files identity. But it's like, I can't tell you how many people outside of, you know, when people were discussing the X-Files in different forum on Facebook, you know, not X-Files fandom, and they were talking about, like, why are they doing these stupid comedy episodes? We hate these. You know, it's like, it's just like this weird sort of jarring reality check that the fandom is just such a different phenomenon than the overall viewership, even to this day, you know, like with the ratings being so diminished in this last season, which, you know, which I find to be a tragedy. I just watched Familiar.
It's a shame, yeah.
Yeah, I watched Familiar again last night, and I was just like, this is just like the most incredible thing. And not only is it like, season two, season three X-Files distilled, you know, it's like the quintessence of it. But just, you know, and its own merits, it's a phenomenal piece of television. And it's interesting, too, because if you really wanted to get fancy, I mean, you could argue that Familiar is sort of, you know, not only tracing back to this, you know, lost child mythology that we see in the teaser of the first episode, but also to Oubliette. I mean, I think there are strands of commonality there. And I think one of the reasons I love that episode so deeply is not only that it's just, I think it's a great piece of writing on its own merits, but it just encapsulates so much of what made the X-Files work in its prime. And I think that, you know, just to bring this again back to Oubliette, it's like this primal human drama of like losing a child. There's nothing more devastating, you know, to a human being, you know.
All right, everyone. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. That just about wraps it up for us today. I mean, if you want to check out a bit more of what Chris has to say, of course, as many of you will know, you can go to his blog, The Secret Son. There's an X-Files tag there you can click on, and he's written loads and loads over the years about the series. So you can do that, or you can check out the complete X-Files book he co-authored as well. As for us on the X-Cast, we'll be back very soon, of course, and you can find us online in all the usual places. But until next time, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/TheXcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/TheXcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.